my teacher's like, don't come back here with a blank tape. And I'm like, oh no. The following interview was conducted on behalf of the oral history program of Century High School. The interviewee is Andy Schroeder, and the interviewer is Diane. The interview took place at Hillsborough Department Station on May 5th, 2005 at 9 o'clock.
Okay, I'm ready if you're ready.
Okay. So, how long have you lived in Hillsborough?
Well, I've lived in this area since 1963.
Wow.
I lived in Cedar Mill, which is over by Sunset High School. Near
uh-huh.
Sunset.
Yeah.
I lived there since 63 and then worked in Hillsborough and Washington County since, you know, it was what, 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I started work in Hillsborough in 1982. Actually, I was a reserve here in like 77,
mm-hmm.
78. So, been here a little while.
So, describe like how it was like throughout like now and every like 1980 to now.
Well, things were a lot different in Hillsborough and even the surrounding area because if you can imagine that, you know where Cedar Mill is at, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of more like the bedroom community of Portland at that mm-hmm. time, kind of like Hillsborough
mm-hmm.
is being developed now. And Hillsborough was predominantly a rural community,
mm-hmm.
a farm, agrarian type based community. Washington County still had a lot of farms. I remember when the last, when the Hesse Pig Farm left here and went to, he moved to Moses Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really kind of a turning point for agriculture in Washington County, where now you don't see any agriculture from Hillsborough east, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, from probably about Forest Grove, there's not a big agricultural component, where before, south of Shoals Ferry, and all of that area from Beaverton to Hillsborough was agriculture. There were
mm-hmm.
farms, and like I say, one of the largest pig farms in the Northwest was there, which is, you know, for us, but I don't know if you like bacon or any ham sandwiches and stuff like that. Yeah, so so there's been, that's changed a lot, because
mm-hmm.
now there's houses and stuff like that. And Hillsborough in particular has been kind of an interesting city in that time, because we have moved completely from a rural city
mm-hmm.
of maybe, 18,000 people when I was hired,
mm-hmm.
To a city of probably over 80,000, really, and 26 square miles. And it's really changed from that rural-type community to an urban center. I mean, we have the largest employer in the state within the four corners of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's one of, I think, the world's leading technology industries around.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a lot of other, you know, we have Sun Micro here, and who in the technology business is kind of another entity, even though they're going broke. But, well, they're not going broke, but they're not doing well in the stock market.
Yeah.
If that's any indication. So Hillsborough's changed a lot. I mean, I remember when the city limits were at the airport. You know, the city limits for Hillsborough ended at where the airport is now. And the
mm-hmm.
Cooler Tavern, now that was the Village Inn, and that was outside the city, which is right down on TV Highway, you know, by Martin mm-hmm. around in there. All of that was outside the city.
And now it's like part of it.
Oh, yeah. Now it's all, oh, shoot, we go all the way up to the Reedville Cafe, and we go all the way up to 185th out in Tennis Corn. Actually, we cross over because we take in Target and that kind of stuff. So it's much different. And the other part of that, too, is that, you know, the city does, I don't know, have you read the Vision 2020? You might get that. It's online, or you can talk to Eric Jensen over at City
mm-hmm.
Hall. But one of the things that the city did is they did a kind of a strategic visioning, and they...
Thanks, Henry. You're a god.
You're welcome.
You don't drink coffee, do you?
I do, but
like
oh, no, thank you.
I've got a very cute little cup here.
I do, it's very... This is my, I think this is Tuscan. Yeah, this is my royal Tuscan. Don't tell anybody, but I love China. It's not very masculine, but...
Oh, I think that's
That's fine. Okay, I'm very secure.
Have you been in China?
No.
Thank you.
Our boss has. He goes to China.
Oh.
I still believe in the big
love
red.
It there.
Would I? Are you from China?
I'm a Filipino, but I've been there before, so...
People say it's a nice place, but, you know, I was raised in the 60s when we were paranoid of the big red threat, you know, and all of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
So I still see the big evil red empire, you know, coming everywhere, like that thing, but I'm getting over it, really. I'm moving through this.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I'm growing.
Describe your career and how it led to your position today.
Well, describe my career. I got into law enforcement because I had problems at school, and my principal was a former Marine. I think he was a little insane, but that's
mm-hmm.
another story.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew that I wasn't in school really to get an education. It was more a social experience for me, and you know, it was about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hanging out with girls or getting in fights or, you know, stuff
mm-hmm.
that you would do probably, you know,
mm-hmm.
it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're in school, I'm sure it hasn't changed too much. But boys were not interested necessarily too much.
Yeah.
And I certainly wasn't. So he put me into the Career Counseling Center. You guys have one of those?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't leave there. That was my class. And he left me there for almost a month. And I didn't do anything, but I figured I could.
Was that your senior year? Or?
No, since I was a junior.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, he makes me take all those tests and things to figure out what you can do for a job because he was a Marine. You know, you need to get a job because you're not going to be successful, you know. And so I took all these tests, and they said, well, we really think you'd be a good forest ranger type biologist or police officer. Well, I figured if I was in the forest, I couldn't, there was nobody to date, there was nothing to do, you know, so I kind of went the police route, and that pretty much started my career. So I think it's 15, 16, and I became like an explorer, you know, and I really got into that, and then I started, you know, and you had to have good grades, so then I kind of started getting a little more academic and doing that kind of thing, and,
mm-hmm.
and when I got out, I became a reserve, and I worked for the Sheriff's Department for a while, so yeah, I'm reformed, and the only problem is, though, I was raised in the Beaverton School District, right, and you got to remember, it was, you know, after the 60s, because I was in the 70s, so, you know, we were dealing with all the burnt burritos that came out of the 60s, you know,
mm-hmm.
when I'm in school teaching now.
Mm-hmm.
Not kidding, none, just love you guys.
She won't hear this.
So, you know, she's like, what are you talking about? But, so I kind of had that experience with teachers, you know,
yeah.
So I knew I didn't want to kind of go that diverted
mm-hmm.
route as it was. But I also was taught, you know, you challenge authority, everything's okay, you know, that
mm-hmm.
very pluralistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of a little bit of a rebel, obviously. My career choice was predicated more on
mm-hmm.
my social life than it was
mm-hmm.
my, But anyway, I loved law enforcement, got into it. When I first started, had a big conflict with authority because if you've never been in the military, if you've
yeah.
never understood that sometimes you have to do what you're told,
mm-hmm.
whether you like it or not,
mm-hmm.
and you get fired if you don't,
mm-hmm.
that was a real concept for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was a dog master and did stuff for a while, got promoted, and just got lucky and got promoted again and again. So and now I'm a commander. It's good work if you can get it. It's a great job.
Good. So is it your job really a racial profiler? Like,
no. Several years ago, on the East Coast, before the New Jersey thing happened, racial profiling was becoming an issue. And of course, our boss, Ron Louie, he's a minority chief. He's Chinese American.
Those girls are interviewing him today.
Are they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're in for a fun ride. He's a good guy. He's a very good boss. Good guy to work for. If you get a chance, he's good to work for. But, and he's a, and one of the things you got to do in law enforcement, probably like anywhere else, is you kind of have to look to see what the next big thing is going to be that'll get you sued or fired or cause you a problem. And we kind of saw racial profiling as a big issue. It was emerging on the East Coast. Then New Jersey, you know, the state police general or whatever he was back there, the guy that ran the state police in New Jersey, pretty much got up and said, yeah, we do racial profiling. He got fired and brought this big national light to it. A lot of laws were going around. We were very worried. At the time, Governor Kitzhaber established a committee to deal with these issues, bipartisan, if you will, and it involved like the ACLU and the defense lawyers and chiefs and sheriffs and stuff and sat down and said, what are we going to do with this racial profiling issue? How do we collect data? And from that, we developed a means by which we collect data and get information. And that's how I became involved. And then just kind of kept up on that.
So it was all the way in the East Coast?
Uh-huh.
And how did it affect us here?
Well, it's interesting that trends in law enforcement usually travel, if you will, from the East Coast to the West. Don't know why that is. I have some theories. Probably because of density of population.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because of the metropolitan nature of cities back east. I don't know if you've been to some of the cities back east. I haven't been outside the country. I don't know if you've been to cities in the Philippines, big metropolitan, you know, millions and millions of people.
Cities. Japan has huge.
Yeah, so you can see that this metropolitan life is much different than even like living in Portland, which we think is a huge city, right? And it's really a drop in the proverbial bucket if you think about Boston or New York or Japan, you know, Hong Kong, that kind of thing. Not the same kind of place. So from those metropolitan areas, obviously can be the forcing bed for new and different things and experiences. And that's no different for law enforcement. Right? We would expect things to, you know, fashion comes from New York, you know, things like that, as well as social trends and that kind of stuff. So if you're really doing your job as a commander and a chief, is you're looking and you're reading and you're trying to identify what those things are. We saw this racial profiling becoming an issue. It actually started largely in Miami-Dade County, where it had these huge, you know, beefs, if you will, politically over the language, over some areas going to Spanish as a primary language and English as a second language, and this created such dissonance. And then you had police doing bad things, getting in riots, shooting people, and that kind of stuff. And when you think about it, you know, interesting, scary facts, right? 80% of the people on death row are a minority. Yeah. And probably 90% of those are one kind of minority, African American or black, whatever is politically correct to say. But so when you look at the justice system and you say, well, justice is blind, I kind of have to call BS on that. Because it. And I'm in law enforcement, and I believe that we don't have an agenda, but clearly when 80 or more percent of the people on death row represent a minority group, you kind of have to look at that and scratch your head and say, you know, at what point does it go beyond coincidence? So there's a certain amount, I think, of unconscious racism, if you will, that exists, if that's such a thing. I don't know if it is, but that's what they tell me.
Sure. And what basically is racial profiling?
Well, I define it, and there's a lot of argument about that, so you have to, I define it in a simple way, because I'm not the brightest guy around. So for me, racial profiling is, in law enforcement, is when you stop somebody, or you make contact with an individual, or you initiate some kind of an event with a person solely based on their race. That's how I would define it. Other practitioners in law enforcement might say things like, they'll put lipstick on this pig, if you will. That's one of my favorite metaphors, is that they'll try to dress it up and say, well, we don't use race solely as a method, but it may be the primary reason. that we stopped somebody. And if you recall post 9/11, because you probably remember that, right? And so,
I didn't even know what those two things were.
Yeah, and you're from the Philippines,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and
I,
the Philippines have a large Muslim,
yes,
contingent,
they do,
right?
Yes, I went to down south around Sambanga, and mm-hmm. there was like terrorists,
yeah,
literally, because I went to a wedding there, and my stepdad couldn't go down there because he was so scared that he was going to, and he's American,
mm-hmm.
so scared to get kidnapped that I was the only person who went down there.
Right, and
they would only take your nationality. Like,
right, so post 9/11, right, the government came out with the rules, and I don't know, that men between the ages of 18 mm-hmm. and I think it was 35, mm-hmm. I think that was the age, could be wrong, but men between that age of 18 and 35 of Semitic descent or of the Muslim faith were profiled. Right, they were identified as you fit in the little window. So mm-hmm. when you would go through the lines at the airports and stuff, okay, you know, all the Muslims over here between this age, well, you can kind of see where it challenges our sensibilities, doesn't it? Doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound right. So
it's more like an assumption.
Yeah, and that's what I think racial profiling is that when you allow your perception of race, mm-hmm. right, to be primary in your mind for your reason of contact, I think you've crossed an ethical, mm-hmm. moral line where the culture would say, our community would say, you know, that's kind of BS, mm-hmm. right? You shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, actually there's a lot of great information about why that's wrong and stuff like that, but I mean, I don't think it takes, I mean, I'm sure any of your peers in school, if given a set of facts and looked at it and said, well, gee, the primary reason you stopped this person was because they were of a particular race.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. It's like being a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get stopped because of your age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're looking for a curfew, that would be
exactly.
That would be justified. And the way our culture has tried to justify some of our profiling is that, well, you know, if you're Muslim, you fall into the category of terrorists. Well, wait a second. Terrorists are an extremist group that represent a very, very small fraction
mm-hmm.
of this Muslim faith, which is huge. I mean, they've got tons of people, just like Catholics or everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't use that as, in my view, as an indicator. In fact, there's a very good book, if you're really interested. It's written by a guy by the name of Professor Harris. He's from the University of Toledo. And he wrote a book called Profiles in Injustice, right? And he's one of the antagonists of law enforcement, if you will. He's kind of like a little stick that keeps poking us in the eye all the time, you know, making us angry. But he points out some of the bad things that law enforcement does. And if you read what he says, he's really a bright guy, because what he talks about is don't judge people, don't pick the criminals
mm-hmm.
based on what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he says, pick criminals, get bad guys based on what they do. Behavior-based mm-hmm. profiling. Ninth Circuit Court has one of the best profiling decisions probably that came out, which is weird because the Ninth Circuit Court at the federal level gets overturned more than anybody else. They're just a bunch of liberal Berkeley people, like I was telling you about the 60s kind of people. That's what you got on the Ninth Circuit Court. They're just not all with us, right? But they came up with a great decision. A guy got on a plane in Hawaii, right? He walks up to the counter, he asks for a first-class ticket. He's got no luggage. He's got no reservation. He pays cash for the ticket. So they want a first-class ticket to Florida. Cops are standing there going, that doesn't look right. Nothing about race, right? Behavior-based. Who walks up to the counter, buys a first-class ticket one way to Florida? What's that about? So they follow the guy. He gets to Florida. He picks up a bag, right? He goes back to the counter. He buys another first-class ticket, one way, back to Hawaii with his piece of luggage and gets on a plane. Now, they know, based on their training experience, that bad guys oftentimes will buy tickets at the counter in cash and fly somewhere, pick up their mm-hmm. drugs, buy another ticket and come back. They know that. Everything they articulated was behavior-based. It was what the bad guy did. Didn't happen to be that he met the age criteria per se. It wasn't that he was one race or another race or anything like that. It was behavior-based. And the Ninth Circuit stood up and said, this is an excellent example of how you profile, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's behavior-based. There's nothing wrong with looking at an individual's behavior and making assumptions about what they're doing. It's not okay to look at a person's race or ethnicity, depending on how you define it,
mm-hmm.
and making assumptions about their behaviors. See what I mean? To see it, you know, and it would be as striking to say that you see me walking down the road, you know, a fat middle-aged white person, you know, well, he must be a Protestant, or he must be, you know, a cat, you know, it's making those kinds of assumptions. We wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of to compare and kind of contrast what profiling is and what it isn't, and that we don't want to confuse that.
So what race do you think is like most like, I mean, this might be mean, but I mean, you guys must have statistics of like what race does more crimes or anything like that.
Well, we do keep track of like arrests. The jail, you could talk to the sheriff about what the race breakdown is of people in jail, that kind of thing. And we keep track of that stuff, but we don't, you know, make reports and saying, okay, you know, which race, you know, gets the prize this week? Who were arrested? I'll tell you an interesting thing about the data that we collect. I'll print this out for you.
Oh, great.
So you can take something back to the teacher that proves you're really here for. Something was found, right? Percentage-wise.
Mm-hmm.
We calculate if you search somebody after you stop them, what's your hit rate? Well, with the Hispanic population, if you will, the hit rate is like 7.4%. For white, it's 11%. For Asian, it's 10%. For black, it's 9%. So if you had that information, right, don't know what that information means to me, right? But what it tells me is that of all of the ethnicities, theoretically, if you're going to search one or the other, the data suggests that you would search the person with the highest hit rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be the white people, right? Yeah. Whatever ethnicity that is. By the same token, now we talk about what's your odds of getting searched, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two different things. You'd have to look at that and say, well, what's the odds that you're going to get searched versus the hit rate?
Mm-hmm.
You would think they would be very close, right? Because you would, I mean, if you're behavior-based, who would you search? You know, you'd search the people who act like they need to be
mm-hmm.
searched. Anyway, so the odds of being searched, this is kind of interesting. For white people, your chances of being searched are 2.5% of the time. Hispanic, it's 4.1% of the time. You're twice as likely to be searched if Hispanic versus white. Blacks are about the same, 2.9, 2.5, Asian 0.8, and Native American is very high, but we only have 15 Native American stops. So, and you have to look at this data too. Let me go grab a copy of it for you real quick.
Thank you.
Look at that data. You can, like I said, you can kind of break that down any pretty much any way that you would like as far as how you look at it. But again, I kind of look at the odds of stops and that kind of thing. The other thing that you have to kind of take into consideration is the different stops require searches, different stops don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you tow a car, you got to do a search. So, do we tow more cars? The other thing you have to look at, especially in data collection, is, you know, the scientific method and modeling and that kind of stuff. And this is very non-scientific. That's one of the biggest errors. I got this book out for you that that talks about analyzing. You can take that as long as you bring it back.
Oh, thank you.
But it talks about, this was produced by the Police Executive Research Forum, and it pretty much tells you everything you want to know and most stuff you don't want to know about data collection, right? And basically what it says, we went to a conference in July of 2004 in Las Vegas to talk about this. Basically what the conclusion was is that, first of all, scientifically speaking, it's really hard to collect good data because you have collector bias, right? Mm-hmm. The cops are entering the codes. You know, ethnicity is a perception. Like, what would I enter for your ethnicity? Well, if I enter Asian, does that properly describe you? Would you rather be preferred to be
Pacific
Islander? You know, so you have this idea of ethnicity, mm-hmm. and we have this idea of race, and they don't meld. You know, do I want to be, you know, Anglo-Saxon, Jute, American, or do I want to be Mediterranean, you know, whatever, kind of a thing. So we have these differences. The other thing, too, is that when you look at it analytically, is that anthropologists who actually study people, cultures, and that kind of stuff, they don't identify people by ethnicity, do they? They identify them by population groups, right? Different population sectors. Well, now we're so global that you can have people that live in, you know, London or Singapore or America, and their ethnicity could be very diverse, theoretically, their genetic ethnicity or their, what, again, anthropologists would call as different populations, because we're such a global, movable society. So that becomes the blur. The other thing I read is that all minority groups are increasing in size, right? So that pretty soon the minority groups are now becoming not the minority, but the majority. And in fact, there's only one population of people that's in decline. And that's the what is termed white group is actually in decline percentage-wise. So that's going to shift over time, right? Because there's this idea of pluralism and everything moves to the center and blah, blah, blah. So that's going to happen. So even that's kind of a moving target. But that book tells you all about how the data is analyzed and that kind of stuff.
Is there a lot of gangs in the Hillsborough area?
I don't know that there's necessarily a lot of gangs, but I think there are gangs in the Hillsborough area. I don't know. You'd have to define a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What would you determine a lot? More than one?
Yeah. Like if they...
There's more than one.
Yeah. If they're giving you like a lot of trouble... In just this area, because I heard there's like this new gang coming from California.
Yeah.
Is that scary? Like, are you guys thinking about anything about that gang?
Well, we've had an increase in activity, and we've seen things since December kind of get busier for us.
Wow.
I don't know that. There are more or less gangs here, per se, but I know that we've seen an increase in activity. And what we've done is we've instituted what we call a street crimes unit or a street crimes investigative unit that's responsible for being the lead and taking initiative on dealing with that problem. We also have an officer in the interagency gang team that Washington County coordinates, and so that's the kind of stuff that we're doing to help deal with that. And I don't know, there's always, you know, someone coming from California or Kalamazoo or somewhere that's going to do bad things and that kind of stuff. So you always kind of have that thing on the horizon. I think it's more about what you see, and I think what we've seen recently, certainly what we've read in the papers and that kind of thing, what we've dealt with in law enforcement, is we've seen an increase in activity. However, we have seen a noticeable decrease in activity as we, you know, kind of started dealing with those issues. And again, we do behavior-based stuff, mm-hmm. right? If you're doing graffiti, we don't care what your ethnicity is. Mm-hmm. You're going to get arrested, and we're going to do something to you. If you're going to do a drive-by shooting, again, we don't care what your ethnicity is.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to deal with the people who act and behave in bad ways, and that's what street crimes is identifying. What's the behavior? Who are the criminal individuals? Because, you know, the theory, the social theory, you've probably heard of it, birds of a feather flock together, you know, your parents will tell you don't hang out with those human friends or whatever, right? Well, there's a certain amount of truth to the theory is that, gee, who you hang out with speaks as much about who you are as what you do. And so we look at people who socialize together, criminals do, you know, and that kind of stuff. So you're looking at those relationships. But again, you have to start there, but then you look for behavior. Are they doing things that make them a criminal? And that's kind of what we focus on, what we've been focusing on. And that's how we'll kind of move forward with the gang circumstances.
Have you ever, like, arrested the gangs or anything?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
What, to what your perspective, like what race you arrest them, do you remember?
Well, in some cases, gangs are ethnic based, and in fact, if you look at the history of gangs and stuff, is they are ethnicity based, especially like you have Latino or Hispanic gangs, which were formed in the barrios of cities where you had these enclaves of Hispanic people, and they're actually people who helped take care of the neighborhood because cops did, right? So they would have these people that would help be, they weren't perceived as bad people, they weren't perceived as, you know, terror units or anything like that. They were perceived as groups of, you know, people who helped take care of the neighborhood, and that's evolved into a bad thing. So there's and I might be oversimplifying that a little bit because you got to define what's a bad thing, but if police ignore a community and in the 50s and stuff, and 40s and 50s and stuff, you know, it was pretty much, you know, there's a lot of racism that wasn't quite so unconscious but was accepted. And, you know, if you lived in the poor side of town, you didn't get police service. If you lived in this side of town, you didn't get police service. I mean, that was pretty prevalent in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Changed in the 60s, but not until the 70s, and it's shocking to know that one of the last desegregated cities didn't have until the late 70s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, when you look at the history of gangs and that kind of stuff, the other thing that's interesting culturally, if you talk about, you know, the Asian or the Pacific Island cultures, if you look at how you have different houses, right, you can be related to different family houses, and that means, you know, you might have tons of people, I mean, huge family gatherings, like, you know, the chief belongs to the House of Louis, which is a huge Chinese conglomerate of families and relatives and stuff. Well, if he needed a loan, right, at one time he would go to the family to get that loan, right? If you belong to one of those houses, you could do that. Those were forcing beds that were created historically to help people grow financially. And we did it in America. You had in New York, you have enclaves of the Jewish community, of the Italian community, of the Polish community. These people were very tight-knit groups of people. They lived in the same areas, and they helped each other because they came to a new country, and were dealing with that. Then you have, from the Asian culture, you have these huge houses that were economically based, right? If you keep the money in the family, we all prosper, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the theory. That's sound economic. It's not racist. It's not because I'm white, I can't go get a loan from them. It's like, no, we want to get rich and prosper and have a better life. The way we do it is that we keep that money in the family, right? And that's really, if you talk about, you know, these ideas of gangs, and we see them as sinister, when you look at the history of them, they actually started out probably with very good intentions. They were groups of people trying to pool their resources to achieve a better existence in whatever, wherever they're at, because you have them almost, you know, globally. You can look at any large gatherings of people where you have, you know, differences, these metropolitan, you know, I know I'm getting off on a tangent. So.
Oh, no, go ahead.
So, anyway, so that's kind of that's how gangs started. Well, from that, you have bad gangs, right? In the East, you have the triads. In Asia and that kind of stuff, you had these criminal families that said, hey, you know, this is really working for the House of Louis and all these other guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we set up a crime family? Hey, we'll call ourselves a triad.
Like, well, the mafia.
Yeah. and then you have the mafia that says, hey, you know, if we pool our resources and we all do criminal stuff together, we are a force multiplier.
So do you think, like, it seems to us, like, us high school students, you know, and I don't know, it's also shown in the media and stuff like that, that most gangs are more race related, like to Hispanics, more than they are to Asians. Do you believe that, or?
I believe several things. I think that, you know, Hispanic gangs have an agenda, right? Asian gangs have an agenda, and there are Asian gangs, and they are around. You probably know that. Probably know that better than I do. And I don't know that one group. I always say, well, you know, some people are smarter than other people. You know, and I kind of look at it that way. If Hispanic gangs have an agenda, they want to do something, whatever that is. I don't know what the goals of gangs are. I really don't. Other gangs, whether it's, you know, Russian mafia, which, you know, we have a certain amount of that occurs, or Asian gangs, or black gangs, whatever it is, they have something that they want to achieve and an end that they want to create. And, you know, I think that if Asian gangs are engaged in criminal behavior and they want to make money doing criminal stuff, they're not interested in getting arrested. They're not interested in bringing attention upon themselves. They're not interested in these other things, right? Mm-hmm. So they act and behave in a manner that is consistent with their goals and objectives. Not that they're smart enough to identify those, but maybe they're brighter than the other groups to be able to say, this is what we want to do, and to do that, we don't want to get in trouble. And frequently that's the case, certainly when you talk to people who've come from San Francisco, police officers who come from San Francisco or Seattle, where they've dealt with these kinds of things, is that these other gangs are more into the violence aspect. It's about turf, it's about, you know, it's about other things that aren't that are criminal in nature, but aren't necessarily related to the profit of being a criminal, like the mafia, like some of the Asian gangs, like some of the Hispanic gangs and stuff. If you're into selling dope, right, and you want to make money selling dope, you don't want to get arrested, you don't want to call attention to yourself, you don't want to be on the police department's hit list, right? You want to fly under the radar screen. And I don't know if dressing up all in one color and throwing down your homie G signs every time a cop goes by, I don't think that's getting it, right?
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that either they're not bright, that's definitely true, or they're not interested in whatever it is that some other people are, where, you know, hey, they don't, I mean, a lot of it, some Asian gangs do have colors and signs and stuff, but sometimes it's much more subtle.
Like the Bloods and the Crips?
Well, yeah, but, you know, but you also have, like, what, the Cobras and that kind of thing and stuff like that, so, and different gangs, but again, you know, I think that, you know, my observation has been, especially when you start talking about the ethnicity issues that relate to gangs, they have different goals and objectives. You know, if your goal is to be a crime syndicate, and we were running it, right, we decided to create a crime syndicate, you know, we probably agree, look, we don't want to get arrested, we don't want to be high profile, we're not going to all dress so that when you're walking down the street, every cop and their mother can figure out what the hell you want, right? We were smart, right? We said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to look like everybody else in this. So I think when you look at gangs, you have to kind of look at them and say, well, you know, and in high school especially, what are they doing in high schools? Well, you know, if you can be different, you know, sometimes that's enough. You know, sometimes it's more the social aspects, it's the recognition aspect, it doesn't have anything to do with anything else. The sad thing is that then once you get in, you're kind of, you know, you don't have any way out.
Mm-hmm.
So then things perpetuate,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that's kind of a downer for them, but nevertheless.
What are the severe changes that you see now and then, just overall, since you've been?
I think the degree of violence is shocking to me at times, that we didn't have the degree of violence in 1982 when I started working. You didn't see the you know, just how violent things can be now. That, you know, 18-year-old kids driving by shooting guns at other people's houses and stuff like that. Young kids doing that.
We have that here in Hillsborough?
Yeah. Need to read the paper a little more. Not being condescending or being an adult or anything, but I mean,
no,
you're drinking coffee, sitting across the table, you need to read the paper, okay? Just make it a goal.
I usually read golf, that's all.
Yeah, you know, you see, there's a front page and then there's the sports page. It's behind the front page. Yeah, you go to the sports page. Good for you. Hey, you know what? It's good to live in that world. No, we have that kind of stuff happens here. And I think that before, I always tell new officers is that when I first got hired here, you could go into a bar fight, and it was just a bar fight, right? It was just a good knockdown, and if you went in and you were a better fighter, you know, the cops won, and, you know, and if you weren't, you got your butt kicked, and the bad guys left you alone. Well, now they take your gun and shoot you. I mean, that's what bad guys do to cops now when you get into a bar fight. So it's that kind of change that, you know, before it was a kinder, gentler bar fight. Now the whole, you know, it's a little more violent. It's a little more dangerous. You know, I like I say, And that goes from an agrarian community, right? We were predominantly agriculture-based. Mm-hmm. We were not interested in being a big city. And, you know, we knew the Olson brothers. I remember going out to Banks and big fight out there. Holy cow, there were just people in the streets, knocked down, dragged out, drunk, carrying on, doing all the stuff that you shouldn't do. Stuff you see on TV, chairs going through the windows of bars, it was just cool. I mean, it was just, just like a movie, you know. But you knew everybody that was, and in the middle of the fight were the three Olson brothers, and the Olson brothers did hay in western Washington County, and I knew them because we bought hay from them. You know, mm-hmm. So you'd go up and you'd tell them, you know, hey, knock that crap off, mm-hmm. you know, and they'd look at you, and they'd look at you long enough that you could jump on them, get handcuffs on them, get them back in the car. You know, nowadays, it's a different time, and again, you know, the violence, the degree of violence is shocking to me at times, mm-hmm. you know, when you have younger kids involved in more violent crimes, and that's kind of a scary thing. Although violent crime is down, who's greatest risk? Juveniles. I mean, they just had a report out of Washington, D.C., I don't know where the article is. I probably have it in here somewhere. But, in fact, it might be in here if I can find it. But they looked at violent crimes in the schools, and what was it? 53 deaths in 3 years or something like that in Washington, D.C. area or something like that, or victims of violent crimes. All of them female. All of them minority. It was some shocking statistics like that. So I think you know that's one of the most shocking things to me that I see today is that the nature of violence is different. It's more severe. You know.
So a certain age group would be like 18-year-olds to 24.
Well, juveniles, anybody under the age of 18. That was a Washington, D.C. statistic. It was some youth violence statistic where I think all of them were minorities and 50% of them were female, something like that, that when you talk about violence in the schools in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But just here, I mean, you look at the types of number of assaults in the second degree, those are serious injury assaults, probably done by a weapon or similar advances. You know, and the younger it gets, the more shocking it becomes. And I think that's kind of the scary thing is the violence is, to me, more severe. It's not just that we got into a knockdown dragout where they broke his nose and they punched his eye out and they ripped his ear off and you know, his kneecap's missing or something. I'm just making that stuff up, but anyway, stuff like that. You know, where a guy picks up a hammer and hits a guy after you get done fighting, you know, that kind of thing. So. That's sad.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's why it's good you're golfing. You get that handicap down, what, about 4? You're good to go.
Yeah.
You'll be making money on the PGA. You'd be like a big break.
Actually, Diana. I want to do that.
That was kind of, what did you think of that blonde chick? I mean, I
the one that won?
Yeah.
She was a whiner.
Yeah.
She was a whiner.
She's kind of a...
But she had a beautiful swing.
I mean, you just watch her hit the ball and just... I would pay for that swing.
Yeah.
I would.
I've been working on my swing for a while. I'm getting a new club, so my state was a very, very awful experience for me this year.
Which one state was?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do good?
What was wrong? 2 rounds of my life. I was driving my ball about 160 yards, and the course is playing 5,700. Into the wind.
Was it your swing, or was it you just...
It was...
Like,
just needed,
concentration?
I just knew... I was all pumped up to play, but, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm getting ready to play. Because usually, like, say, I usually get scared, but this day, I just kind of like, you know your game.
Mm-hmm.
Just go out there and play, because the more I get nervous, the more I don't play well. And so I just played, and, like, the first few holes, I was, like, in the first front nine, I was in the top 5. And the back nine just killed me. I mean, I think I was, like, 10 over. Or 11 over in the back.
Wow.
It was horrible.
Not good.
You know, and I saved my... I never reached one green regulation both days.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Up and down. A short game probably saved me 100%.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was off the tee then that you were sucking then?
Yeah. So I'm getting a new driver, and In my head.
What kind of driver are you going to use?
Well, I went to this guy who makes custom-made drivers, and I went to him because I'm so sick of just buying, mm-hmm. like, those driver's drivers. I want one for my own, for myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And so.
Now, what are you using for long irons? Are you going to the metal woods, or are you... Can you use metal woods in regulation? You can, though.
Metal woods?
Yeah.
Because you pay them, don't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, do you ever go undercover?
No, that is dangerous.
Oh.
I don't mind wearing a uniform and, you know, but going undercover, okay. That's for the young kids that want to, you know, live life in the fast lane and do that kind of stuff. But
wow.
It's very dangerous.
What would you change about your work?
What would I change about my work?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to do less kind of budget stuff like that, and I'd like to be able to be more, you know, operationally involved, like be out on the road more. As a commander, I do a lot of stuff that makes the organization run, budgeting and labor stuff and policy decisions and that kind of stuff, but it's very much not like.
Mm-hmm.
The only times I get to go out is when something, you know, really significant happens, like when they have the white powder up at the juvenile justice building mm-hmm. last week, you know, that kind of stuff. Other than that, I kind of pretty much have to hang out here and, you know, do interviews and that kind of thing, which are fun, don't get me wrong, it's been great. Especially the off-tape stuff that we were talking about.
What have you enjoyed most over the span of your career?
Chasing bad guys.
Really?
Oh,
how is that like?
It's fun. Law enforcement is absolutely...
Testing. Okay, chasing bad guys.
Yep, that's a great game. Love it. Best job. Absolutely, without a doubt. Chasing bad guys is fun. Going out every day, not knowing who's going to go to jail, and you know, it's a good job.
Do you actually go run and be like, hold your hands up? And
sometimes, you know, if they run, we chase them.
Do you like car chases better?
I've never been a big car chase guy. When I say catch bad guys, you know, you go out and you try to find out who did the crime, and it's the whole cat and mouse thing.
Investigating
and being able to bring them in and questioning them and getting them to confess. It's all very, you know, fun. You have to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, golf. If you like it, it's a great game. If you don't, it's just when you take the stick and hit this little ball 500 yards down the field into a little hole. When you say it like that, it just sounds
really
stupid.
Really bad, yeah. That was really bad. Have you gotten any special awards in your department?
I've got a few.
Do you have any memorabilia or documents that you want to give us?
No. What are you looking for?
Just like...
Here, I'll give you... I got something for you.
Like photos, diaries, letters, documents, awards, newspaper articles. Anything that would help us finish our research.
I'll give you this. It's a tie clasp, but we'll pull the little chain off and then it can be like a tie clasp.
Tie clasp?
Yeah, so
oh.
Like a little lapel pin. Pull that off. Come on, you little girls.
That's funny.
There you go. You just kind of put that on your lapel. You have a nice little badge thing on your
head. Thank you.
I don't know if you want to wear that at school, they might make fun of you, but, you know, definitely when you're
No, talking, actually, no, can, they don't.
You can say, hey, I'm a junior policeman, and I'm going to book you.
My dad's like, don't get arrested today, okay? And
yeah.
I'm like, I hope not. It's really funny. And last question, what area of Hillsborough gives you the most trouble?
What area of Hillsborough gives us the most trouble? Mm-hmm. That's kind of a tough question to answer. I think that, I guess my you know, trouble how? Sometimes when the city councils, you know, they're trouble. That was a joke. there's that. I think trouble kind of moves. If you look, these are densities. These are calls for service by density, right? I have these made up so that if you look at, and these are based on an acre lot. So okay. If you like, you see where the color, this is where we have the most density of calls for service. And these are broken down by shift. This is days. There's swing. No, this is day shift. These are threes and fours. Those are ones and twos. These are simultaneous multiple response high priority calls, right?
Wow.
So you kind of have that. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see, so would you say that this is the problem area? I don't know. We go there a lot. Or is that a problem area?
Where is that?
Versus, this would be downtown. This would be like baseline and fifth.
Okay.
Downtown. And again, these are acre, you have to look at these in acre squares because that's how the calls are distributed. Based on, you know, but you can see that we have different, here are all the light rail stations, so does that mean they're busy?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those things where you really kind of have to, you kind of have to ask, what do you mean, is there one area that's more busy or less busy than another? And that's a pretty open-ended question. I would say that activity follows population density,
okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look in the downtown or this core area or this area here, is that probably during the day, most of the day, we have a large density of people that come through and in and around this area. This is the downtown, you know, we're a county seat. City of Hillsborough is a county seat, mm-hmm. So we have, we attract people who come to get their restitution. You know, we have the community corrections. So we have a lot of people who are in the justice system that are coming to and from Hillsborough for the purposes of being, you know, monitored or that kind of thing. And then you have, like, if your boyfriend's in jail, I know that may not resonate with everybody here, but then you have to visit him, right? So you would come to Hillsborough, or you might get stopped there. Or you might be contacted, that kind of thing. So the whole, and all the social services are run through the county, right? The employment offices here, welfare, all of that stuff is run through the county. So you got to kind of look at density. So if there were a problem area, I would, and then it would be wrong for me to point, because if I, as a commander, say, oh yeah, that's a problem area there, then mm-hmm. the property values go down, I get sued, and, you know, I'll be racist, or I'll be something, mm-hmm. right, because that might be a low economic district, mm-hmm. or it might be, you know, someplace where someone will take offense to that, so. I don't know. I think that activity kind of follows the population
mm-hmm.
and the density of population, so I kind of look at the places where people conflagrate, that's a good word, and look at that as where the problem areas are going to be, if they're going to be problems.
That's interesting.
It's very, actually very interesting. That was 100, that's looking back 180 days. And the interesting thing is, again, when you can see them all lined up, like these are priority ones and twos, right, here. And then when you start looking at threes and fours, then you can see how Tanasbourne expands, right, out of Evergreen Parkway. Mm-hmm. But what does this follow? This follows density. And I have another map. It's not here, but this is my density map. And you see these are parcels and apartment complexes with over 100 units of these orange ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the light rail stations, and then you have the business areas with more than 200 employees, little black squares and that kind of stuff. And the only thing is that we don't see, like, the sheriff's department isn't marked on here, and community corrections and that kind of stuff. So if you looked at this, where you're talking about employees with 100 people and that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
you would see that this area has density, has population density. So
interesting.
That's probably way more information you want to know. But
No, that's great, because we have to get as much information as we can through this thing. And if you would like to, we are presenting this on June 15th. June 15th in the lecture room at 9:45. No, sorry, 8:45.
It's basically what we have researched, talking about this whole thing. We've talked to the mayor, we've talked to different people around Hillsborough. And I think it's going to be pretty interesting what we find out. And we know what to do about it.
Absolutely. I will be there.
Thank you.
Put it in my calendar. And if there's other...